I believe it's important to go back to what this sovereignty is made of. Bitcoin works because an economic majority is aligning incentives for every constituent of the network. The longer tail of the economic distribution may choose to run a node and validate consensus, but ultimately, consensus follows the money. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we have got a piece. We are continuing with our sidechain article series, our thread of articles back and forth about this idea of really breaking down into the, with like kind of a fine-tooth comb, what Bitcoin's evolutionary path looks like when we're talking about a billion users. And we've already covered probably basically five or six episodes on this topic, because I covered the first Drive Chains article from BitMEX, and then the piece by AJ Towns, which I've got linked to all of these because Alex B. mentions them in this article and links to them. So I'll have links to the actual reads if you haven't covered them yet. I mean, it doesn't really change anything about this piece, but it's really, really great context. This is going to make a whole lot more sense if you listen to those episodes. So there's 757, 758, and I think 760, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, and 759 is actually Blockstream's piece about interoperable sidechains and Liquid and Lightning and all of these things. So I think it's very, very relevant, and I just wanted to kind of cover it, both as part of a break from the series, but also it was just really relevant to what we are talking about. So this is essentially a follow-up to Fiat Jaffe's article on DriveChain's future in Bitcoin. And he lays out a really good argument that I touched on, same sort of concept that I touched on in, I think it was in the Guy's Take of James O'Byrne's episode, so it was 758. But Alex B. does a really good job in this piece, basically kind of fleshing that out a little bit more. So we will do a recap in the Guy's Take. This show is brought to you by CoinKite, the makers of the Cold Card, the Block Clock, the Block Clock Mini, the Block Clock Micro, the Open Dime, the Sats Card, the Tap Signer, just so many amazing Bitcoin security and hardware products. You have got to check them out if you haven't. 9% off the Cold Card with the code BitcoinAudible. Special just for you guys. Details will be right there in the show notes. This show is also brought to you by Fold, the makers of the Fold debit card. I just don't know what else to say other than having my entire fiat banking life give me sats back in every possible way, whether it's gift cards with 2%, 3% back, 7% back sometimes, normal grocery expenditures and bills that all give me 1% back. I can't imagine ever going back to old shitty fiat that just doesn't, where I just pay all these bills and get nothing. If you aren't doing this and you want 100,000 sats for free, go to my link, bitcoinaudible.com/fold. It's right there in the show notes. And lastly, if you want to accept Bitcoin in your online store or for your project or for your e-commerce, anything, and you want it to be as simple as possible, you want Bitcoin on chain, you want Lightning, and you just want it to work, nodeless.io. Nodeless is a no KYC service that does all of the heavy lifting and just forwards all payments directly to you. Check out my referral link at bitcoinaudible.com/nodeless, and you can make your own referral link for the other people that you know who want to receive Bitcoin and don't want all the headache. Send them to Nodeless. All right, with that, let's jump into today's read. And it's titled, A Sound Bitcoin Financial System, written by Alex B. Seeing as a handful of developers have been riffing on the current challenges of Bitcoin's evolutionary path, I thought I'd throw my hat in the ring and offer, perhaps, a less technical take on some of the themes being explored. For those just tuning in, the gist of the conversation revolves around the prospect of Bitcoin scaling to billions of users, and whether or not they get to enjoy its lauded sovereign properties. The premise is simple and well publicized by now. Blockchains don't scale. UTXOs are unwieldy and expensive to transfer. Lightning, while universally acknowledged as a cornerstone of the puzzle, does not appear sufficient on its own. AJ Towns does a pretty good job laying out the technical argument in this post, so I will spare you the details here. A link to read 757 with AJ Towns putting the B in Bitcoin is available in the show notes if you have not read or listened to that article. The dreary conclusion everyone seems to arrive at is that users will need to interface with a range of entities, each with their own position on the decentralization spectrum. Centralized custodians, Chaumian mints, federated sidechains, coin pools, etc. AJ, for himself, muses on a scenario wherein the user base is spread across a large enough number of such entities so that demand for Bitcoin transactions can be met without introducing systemic risks. A lot of thought goes into the prospect of equipping those adjacent protocols with minimal validation costs and maximize transparency in order to keep everyone in check and honest. A more recent post by core developer James O'Byrne opines along the same line. The link to read 758 is also available in the show notes. Offering various thoughts on the set of trade-offs available to us and further exploring the design space. Of note, he emphasizes the importance of users having the option to exit from a selected operation so as to incentivize the latter to abide by the rules. In a response, developer Fiat Jaff rejects this proposed paradigm. A link to read 760 is also available in the show notes. Suggesting that Bitcoin's time is running out, he argues in perhaps fatalistic fashion that if we are to risk the presence of any scale of custodianship into Bitcoin, we might as well hand over the keys of the kingdom to the devil we know rather than one we don't. That is what drive chains are, in essence. An idea which prescribes that the dynamic set of proof-of-work signers enrolling to secure the Bitcoin blockchain should also be relied on as custodians to achieve a trust-minimized two-way peg. The underlying assumption being that fees generated by those sidechains should be sufficient to incentivize miners not to defraud their users. An entire article could be written about my issues with the proposal, but for the sake of brevity, I should only point out that the incentives, if any, are completely orthogonal to the ones miners have towards securing the Bitcoin chain. The economic majority. Interestingly enough, this leads us to the core of the challenge. How can we engineer systems inspired by the incentives that secure Bitcoin? As James observes in his article, quote, "The ability to appeal to layer one is what makes it all work." People have been discussing the opportunity to use the chain as an adjudicator for the better part of Bitcoin's existence. Obviously, Lightning was the first protocol to leverage this idea. Anyone who has explored these types of constructs quickly noted that this comes with a major caveat. Indeed, appealing to Layer 1 might prove costly, so much so that it may become outright uneconomical for some users to do so. I imagine this is what Fiat Jaff is referring to when he says, quote, "Off-chain solutions like Lightning and Arc will not scale, and they basically lose usefulness as more adoption happens and fees rise." Users who cannot afford increasingly expensive Layer 1 justice will find themselves in a quasi-custodial scenario. The argument that usually follows is that if the average user has to compromise on sovereignty to use Bitcoin, then the project has failed. With that in mind, I believe it's important to go back to what this sovereignty is made of. Bitcoin works because an economic majority is aligning incentives for every constituent of the network. The longer tail of the economic distribution may choose to run a node and validate consensus, but ultimately, consensus follows the money. The cost of validation, though, is not proportional. It's increasingly prohibitive to skip validation the more bitcoins you own. Everyone should be encouraged to validate so long as they are perusing layer one, regardless of their size. That said, it is more important that a supermajority of bitcoins received be validated than it is for a supermajority of bitcoiners to receive and validate. As long as we can maintain this incentive alignment, everyone benefits from the guarantees provided by the network. Multi-party protocols. Having considered this, we can return to the matter of our inquiry into protocols, products, and services that can mirror those economic guarantees. The most promising area of research at the moment appears to be coin pools. Multi-party protocols allow an arbitrary number of users to lift their UTXOs into a shared single one. Using Script, an infinite variety of contracts can be designed that allow those pools of UTXOs to interactively update the distribution of Bitcoins within and across them. Much like Lightning, those contracts allow users unilateral exit from the pools at a cost. The latter situation can become especially dire the larger they grow. Coordination is typically expensive. In Lightning, tangential issues have led to the emergence of Lightning Service Providers, or LSPs. A new and interesting idea proposes to introduce coordinating services into coin pools, allowing for very efficient management of the user's nested capital. A group of them could connect through a service provider who will exchange their UTXOs for virtual ones. The service provider is responsible for maintaining the state of the pool by posting regular on-chain transactions, updating the collective UTXO. In between, quote, rounds, the provider handles payment requests between users of the pool by initiating atomic transfers between the sender and the recipient. All of those payments, an arbitrary number of them, happen off-chain. The process completes only if those transfers are bundled and confirmed in a Bitcoin block, removing the need for trust in the service provider. As counterparty to every exchange, the scheme is very capital intensive for service providers, who are required to fund every pool transaction. To handle the liquidity requirements, virtual UTXOs or VTXOs are ephemeral. The contracts that underlie them come with an expiry clause that returns the associated user UTXOs to the service provider. Users must, therefore, make sure that their contracts don't time out to preserve spending authority over the funds. Updating a contract is trivially achieved by refreshing your virtual UTXO through a pool transaction. To better manage this, VTXOs come with different duration, and users can select what fits them best. In exchange for the liquidity, service providers charge processing fees which are expected to vary according to the cost of capital. Indeed, VTXO contracts of varying duration can be funded by setting a rate at which the provider can tap into capital markets to match the demand with an offer. The formation of those markets will allow service providers to operate at scale and may usher in a new type of reference rate for capital. If you're paying attention, you'll realize what we have here is a pretty neat set of incentives that can align individuals at scale. An economic majority afforded with unilateral exit from pools can incentivize operators to be accountable for the interests of every user. Pennies in front of a steamroller. Of course, users of multi-party protocols are similarly burdened by the cost of unilateral claims. Virtual UTXOs could become prohibitive to withdraw on-chain, leaving no option for its owners but to rely on the incentives of the system. Those users may still be able to transact through the pool, but in the event of fraud from the operator, they will be stuck with little resort. Operating a coin pool is assumed to be a profitable operation. At scale, it may in fact be extremely lucrative. Those service providers, operators, or ASPs being discussed have the potential to become a fundamental institution of Bitcoin's future financial markets. A new generation of banks leveraging native Bitcoin capital markets and offering a range of services built atop their coin pool. So long as a supermajority of the Bitcoins entrusted to them maintain sovereign rights, the system is economically aligned. Any bank who would attempt to profit from vulnerable users is likely to lose business precipitously. By being naturally compatible with CoinJoin architecture, coin pools also provide strong censorship resistance assurances. Lightning is positioned perfectly as a trust-minimized clearinghouse between those entities and allows users to route payments across the network of pools and beyond. Considering virtual UTXOs still require block confirmation, they can function as a sort of checking account and support different payment methods. To enable further throughput and velocity, a Bitcoin bank may also operate ancillary protocols that can facilitate those operations. Chaumian eCash mints, state chains, and even more expressive sidechains. Crucially, the trust assumptions for those services remain rooted in the coin pool operation. The same game theory applies across the board. Picking the pockets of its eCash users risks undermining the bank's entire operation. Pennies in front of a steamroller. These are, I believe, the seeds of a sound Bitcoin financial system. One that preserves the property rights of its participants using thoughtful economic incentives. Despite the very best advances in zero-knowledge technologies and other exotic primitives, I remain skeptical that a perfectly egalitarian protocol can emerge that guarantees trustlessness at global scale. Sovereignty is expensive and is not innate to Bitcoin or its technology. It is but the result of collective individual incentives. The number of you people that still have your Bitcoin on Coinbase or Binance and aren't holding your own keys is too damn high. You know what this is about. You know why we do this. Get a cold card and just hold your own keys. You get a regulatory crackdown? Coinbase doesn't have your keys. They get hacked? Coinbase doesn't have your keys. They make a critical error and lose a bunch of Bitcoin? Coinbase doesn't have your keys. And you can even get a cold card with 9% off. Code BITCOINAUDIBLE gets you that sweet discount. You guys know how volatile and crazy this space can be. Get a cold card, get your 9% discount, withdraw your Bitcoin to it, and sleep easy at night. It is such a small thing that you can do that can save you so much pain and frustration down the road. Go to BITCOINAUDIBLE.com/coldcard. All right, so I thought this article was really great, and the conception or the design that Alex is talking about in this piece is essentially ARC, the one that we did with Burak in chat 80, I believe. So I'll have the link in the show notes for that too. If you haven't really taken a deep dive into ARC, it's a really, really valuable setup, and it's absolutely fascinating. It's still totally in kind of theory and development stage, and there are a couple of decisions I think that Burak makes that I don't think are totally necessary that kind of add an additional burden, like the coin join rounds, like the idea that you would do these every 5 seconds rather than just every 10 minutes when, you know, essentially a confirmation on chain is all that, like publishing it into the mempool is the degree of security you get anyway before it hits the next block, and it severely limits the scaling potential of it. It doesn't limit the scaling potential. In fact, just the opposite. It benefits it by being much, much larger. It's just the opposite. It causes a really difficult bootstrapping problem because it's more costly the smaller it is, and you can't amortize the cost. It essentially creates a worse economies of scale than I think there needs to be. But anyway, that's all beside the point, and it's a completely different episode, but I'll have it in the show notes if you want to dig in. But the basic idea is just that there is a means of doing a massive amount of off-chain transactions in which each user holds the virtual UTXO or virtual TXO that enables them to then exit back to the base chain in the case of a malicious or non-existent, a disappearing provider. And I think it's also important to note that there's no specific reason why this provision, this service provision piece of it, cannot be a federated thing, so that, you know, with 60 or 100 different entities that are running this and all providing liquidity and capital, is that not only do they essentially get protection if they have their own BTXOs, they're getting protection from each other, so it's this larger business arrangement. But it can also, if it's like a 70 of 100 multi-sig or federation or something, is that, well, if any 10 of them go offline for any technical reasons or whatnot, then the entire system can continue to operate. So I think it makes a lot of pretty obvious sense that the largest service providers who are always online and have enormous amounts of capital to allocate to this thing ought to create a federated version of this, because it essentially mitigates some of the most likely forms of both the trust issue of any attempt at rug pulling, and then obviously the more important in my thinking is the technical issue that essentially forces everyone to exit on chain. But essentially, this article is a more nuanced and or lengthy explanation of how essentially the economic majority are subsidizing or essentially protecting the incentives for everyone who doesn't have the capital necessary to exit on chain unilaterally. And for all intents and purposes, this is essentially true of Bitcoin consensus as well. The singular dynamic is that in the, or the singular, the most important element of that puzzle, so to speak, to me, is that in the absence of profound conviction in knowing that you want to alter consensus, there's an insanely powerful force towards the shelling point of not changing consensus. And if it even looks like there's a significant enough economic base that is dead set against the consensus change, the path of least resistance and most high the highest assurances is always to maintain the current consensus. And this is specifically why the UASF worked. And it's essentially the immutability by the law of the intolerant minority, unwilling to allow or enable consensus changes. And I think that pressure, if there is enough economic pressure there, the economic majority will naturally lean that way as well. Because I think it's important to note that essentially in every political struggle, there's always this huge group of undecided. But we've deviated a little bit from Alex's point, is that at the end of the day, the economic majority, for all intents and purposes, determines what Bitcoin is. And the beauty of the system is that it properly aligns the incentives of the economic majority to protect that consensus from malicious changes. Now, what Alex is talking about in this piece is how do you leverage the ownership of the economic majority in something like the sidechain systems, or sidechain again is not the word. Let's just take ARC again for the example, since he's specifically kind of laying out the structure of ARC as a design or as a system, is that people always have the option of returning to on-chain in order to exit their Bitcoin from the system. Now, what I talked about in the, I think it was read 758, if I'm not mistaken, but in the guy's take, was that essentially the highest value customers, like I gave the example of $1,000 on-chain fees, but it doesn't really matter what it is. It's just anything above the threshold of the fee amount. All of those players, all of that economic potential able to exit unilaterally means that they are essentially subsidizing the cost of the security for everyone below that threshold. And I really like the analogy of pennies in front of a steamroller, is that you're the potential benefit of taking all of the small balances while being essentially decimated by the larger balances. And at the exact same time, you're putting something on chain where right now you have an on-chain footprint that is massively profitable and has an extraordinary network. We're assuming a very, very valuable and very successful ARC that has a lot of capital to steal. Now, it's important to remember that the network itself, even aside from its fee-generating potential, is just by itself an incredibly valuable thing. Because the bigger that ARC is, the more liquidity it has, then it's not only valuable for the whatever the fee structure is inside the user base of the ARC, but it also becomes a massive position in the Lightning Network and all sorts of transaction batching sort of services that I genuinely expect to be like a very, very common thing in a Bitcoin future when we're looking 5 to 10 years out, and always full blocks and essentially high fees. So when your potential for theft literally starts from the very bottom, from the poorest of customers or the poorest of users up to essentially the fee threshold, and you still have this element where a lot of the users, even in that base, can at least burn their transactions, that can burn their amounts by executing the exit and just paying it all in fees, then you're essentially looking at the cannibalization of an extremely valuable long-term asset for increasingly small short-term gain. And I just like the analogy of pennies in front of a steamroller, is that the balances that you want to be able to get are specifically the ones you won't be able to. And you know, when we talk about like Lightning not being increasingly not secure because of the fees going up and stuff, I think it's important to remember that despite this, like this element, like we get to see this at work all the time, actually. You know, like I get zaps all the time on Noster that are 10 sats, 42 sats, one sat even, like tons of them. And essentially, by every measure, that HTLC is quote-unquote trusted with your channel partner because you can't take that to the main chain. You're never going to settle a one-sat address on the main chain and pay two fees, you know, one out and then one back in. So why does it work? Why is it that this isn't regularly attacked? And I think the reason is pretty simple and actually has two different elements to it. One is that it's just not much, like, the dynamic of them taking it is the same as you settling it. And then if it's just a malicious actor trying to DDoS the network, essentially, with really small transactions and basically locking up all of the HTLC memory, all the bandwidth of your node or any channels, is that you can essentially just dump it all and then raise fees. Like, even though I don't think this is built into any node, if this ever occurred, it wouldn't be too terribly difficult to mitigate. Because Lightning works on the same sort of fee structure design as the base layer, in the sense that spam is just priced out. Now, in its current iteration and what we expect, because we just kind of expect Lightning to work and it keeps just working, I think we're not really prepared properly for that scenario. But as humans always do, we essentially will just go with what works for a really long time until something breaks and then we fix it. So as soon as this occurs, I think it just kind of becomes the standard that there is some sort of a failsafe or some sort of a response to this. But because the incentives are pretty much aligned, I don't think it's very likely to happen. Now, I'll fully admit that that's not a good argument at all. And I wouldn't accept that from anybody else in designing a system like drive chains or whatever. It's like, oh, well, it's just not going to happen. If it's possible, it's probably going to happen at some point. But that's where going back to the arc idea is that the bigger issue, in my opinion, is actually a bug. One that essentially locks up some key or some sort of hardware failure that forces everyone to exit on chain. And the bigger the arc is, even if there are no malicious actors whatsoever, they can still completely fill up the blocks and basically cause a massive problem and then open it to a malicious attack. And God forbid this attack is coming from not the ARC provider, but somebody who hacks the ARC provider and gets their keys and does this specifically to bloat the mempool and raise all the transaction fees because they don't have any skin in the game. They're not losing the network. They're punishing the ARC. They lose nothing at all. All they get is any pennies that they can grab, any small users that are stuck, and increasingly larger users. You know, maybe fees spike up to $5,000 during this episode because, you know, the larger economic pool is trying to make sure that they settle their transactions. Well, then that means that there's more and more potential to essentially steal from a larger group of people. The incentives really aren't in play at all because we're not talking about the ARC provider. We're not talking about the relationship between the provider and the user. We're talking about the relationship of a hacker and how they can exploit the security measure of the system itself. Now, one thing that I suspect, especially with CTV, I think we're going to get CTV. I'm basically acting under the assumption that we will get CTV or OptX hash or anything like that, which allows you to create a commitment transaction, where you can pay out to a UTXO that essentially has the proof that all that this one transaction can do is then pay out to 100 set places with set amounts. So it's essentially one of the most important pieces of the puzzle for shared UTXO ownership, the ability to share one address and one balance with a ton of different people. But it specifically requires coordination. So the reason I think this and ARC, like what would I immediately assume as the mitigation technique of this sort of a bug or this sort of a problem is literally block size or block space insurance is that you can have the CTV for in this arc. You can have the virtual UTXO or virtual TXO that pays out to your address, but you can also have one with a insurance company with a service that provides a mass batching system where you actually pay out to the insurance pool. So it's essentially an exit from a coin pool into a coin pool. And so rather than having to pay $1,000 for an on-chain fee, you pay $1 a month or $5 a month over Lightning or something, or even within the coin pool, like within the arc, to a service provider, to an insurance company that without custody of your funds at all, makes a coordinated batch transaction with all the other customers of the insurance company to essentially start up a new pool, because you can have an unlimited number of branches here. You don't have to just have the branch where it goes straight to the user. You can have a branch where it goes to a multi-sig, a branch where it goes to, again, another coin pool or a federation, or it dumps into the liquid side chain. And when we're talking about a world where $100 fees are normal, I don't think anybody will interact directly with the base chain without some sort of a service or some peer-to-peer cooperative close or batching. And whatever degree of interactivity that requires, I think that will just become the market norm. And it will probably be because of a lot of disasters along the way that led to those sorts of things being developed. But this is exactly what sort of low time preference enables in the market. So a great example is that if you actually look at the market dynamics, so I go back like 50, 80 years or something, when we had something reasonably close to what was sound money in this country, insurance was incredibly popular and incredibly common. Now, when we have fiat world and we have the manipulation of debt, insurance is increasingly a seemingly stupid thing to purchase, and it's been completely disincentivized. And so instead, what we have basically in place of insurance is leverage. But when you have long-term capital assets that you can irrecoverably lose, insurance makes a lot of sense. And one of those things that I expect the market to change, like one of those major ways in which I expect the market to shift in the face of a sound monetary system and a sound financial system, is that leverage disappears. Because look what happens to leverage. Look at what happens in crypto and Bitcoin. Every single time we have these huge leveraged moves, that is the fiat behaviors, the fiat relationships, and the fiat mentality being printed onto the Bitcoin and crypto system. What happens? They get eviscerated. They get their asses handed to them, because you can't leverage a sound monetary asset, something that you can't print. Basically, the exact practices that work so well in the fiat world will just get you obliterated in Bitcoin land. And at best, those cycles last for like 2-3 years. So despite the fact that I think we still have a whole lot of the fiat market that's going to come in and make this mistake over and over again, I think the really strong base, the long-term and slowly shifting value towards the economy and the part of the ecosystem that, again, may just have to take the time it takes for people to get clobbered and realize that they are making stupid decisions. A great example are everybody listening to this podcast, no offense, who still has their Bitcoin on Coinbase or Binance. I really don't want anyone to be the ones that learn the hard lessons, but on a long enough time frame, you learn the hard lessons. But going back to what I think this means for market change is that there's going to be a huge base, and I think the incredible value add of Bitcoin in a financial market system outside of the payments technology and the medium of exchange stuff with Lightning and potentially stable coins on top of Bitcoin, which I still think are actually a viable use case. They're actually a useful thing. I mean, it's still a shitcoin. It's still fiat. It's still totally credit by some other institution, but that doesn't mean it's not valuable. So aside from that, the one thing that Bitcoin can provide that literally doesn't exist, the very notion, the concept of collaborative custody, of multiple people sharing the ownership and the risk profile of a single UTXO or of a single contract, is totally unique to Bitcoin and this ecosystem. And then the ways of providing infrastructure and services that do not compromise that, the LSPs, Nodeless, Unchained, Greenlight, and the Breeze SDK, Arc, Liquid, all of these things are something that's entirely novel to the Bitcoin space. And going back to the episode that we had with Callie, or reading Callie BTC's piece about running LN.tips, and how they essentially ran a global, globally available anonymous service, no KYC service, financial service, and payment service for like tens of thousands of users on a mirrored Raspberry Pi, on just like a one redundancy Raspberry Pi setup. In that same sort of sense, you know, we don't have to think of insurance as like Geico. This could literally just be something with like a keep room of all your friends and family, or all the everybody that you know who's in the same arc as you, with a few hundred people that like every 6 months or something updates the output transaction, the CTV, and that's what everybody, that's one of the branches in the arc that everyone is using in what they have as their payout script. And I think it's really important to not dismiss these other protocols that we have. The dynamics and the security elements and the cooperative, the interactivity necessary for a lot of these things on Lightning and on Bitcoin for these more collaborative and like complex constructs. These things are made vastly easier with decentralized identity and key systems, and also peer-to-peer private pools of data or information or chat. So Valid, Keet, and Hole Punch, Synonym, Nostr, I do not think these things are separate. I think these things could be major components of exactly the sort of ecosystem, the environment necessary to provide these sorts of services to people in a way that doesn't create this need for these giant, distant, faceless corporations. You know, I've talked about this before on the podcast about what trust is and why trust is like critical to a market. And I can't remember whose piece we read, but there was somebody who framed it, and I really loved this framing, and it was something that was kind of, that they did a really good job of articulating something that was in my head and I couldn't quite put my finger exactly on it. But that the fact that Bitcoin is trustless or extremely and highly trust minimized means that you are able to restore trust in the market between other participants. Like the whole point of the market and the point of, you know, a social sphere, a society, is literally to build trusted arrangements, to build agreements, to engage in trade and cooperative action. What this technology does more than anything else, and Nostr, and Hole Punch, and Vate, like all these other things, these pieces of the puzzle that we're slowly getting together that aren't even explicitly about Bitcoin, they enable these trusted relationships and these business and service provider relationships at a completely different scale in a completely different way without any sort of geographical restriction. Like, it doesn't matter where Cali BTC puts their LN tips Raspberry Pi. Anybody in the world can use it because it speaks Lightning. And when you have free flowing money on a social graph, in a social network, I really think what we're going to see, I think Nostr, whatever is successful, is essentially most successful in that regard for a social graph. The idea that everybody's just going to be an influencer or, you know, make videos, I don't think so at all. I think it's going to be the dominant graph for business relationships. Again, Bitcoiners are builders. I say this all the time, but I'm constantly shocked by some new thing that I find and I'm interested in, and then I find Bitcoiners already there trying to build something or provide some sort of service. I think we are going to be each other's service providers. And when I say block space insurance, I'm not saying that you're going to have to get it from Geico or, you know, American Insurance Agency or Liberty Mutual or whatever. You might get it from me. And it would be a benefit for me to run this service for the Audionauts or whatever the hell it is, because I get the service too. I just end up kind of being like a coordinator for the batch transaction. And anybody who joins gets the benefit of working with somebody that they know, that they can message, and that has thousands of hours of explaining how I think about it and what, you know, what my values are. There is nothing stopping me from providing that service to people. Same with the Arc. Except that sounds like a lot of work, and I don't really want to do that one. But I think you get the idea. But anyway, I've rambled quite a bit, and I need to get back to Lynn Alden's book, Broken Money. Yes, the rumors are true. I am working as fast as I can on the audiobook. I do not have a proper timeline. Right now, my goal is at minimum 10 pages a day. But things change. Travel happens, you know, all sorts of things. So I don't know exactly how long that takes, but I'm pushing through it as fast as I can so I can get this out to you guys. So anyway, a shout out to Alex B for this article. Hopefully this thread will be done and we won't be including any more, but you know, this conversation is always open. It's never ending. And don't forget, especially on Noster, because I'm trying to use Twitter less often, but one of the few things that I still get value out of Twitter is the top articles feature. Man, it saves me so much time just being able to sort through all the articles that people are sharing. So I will extend another call to action to you guys. Please share any articles that you want to hear and that you didn't have. Like, if you save something or you highlight something, anything that you're interested in hearing, please tag me in it. This will really help me sort through the interesting stuff that people are getting into or debating or whatever it is. It's really just a great way to help me curate. And I super, super appreciate it. So with that, another thank you to our amazing sponsors, CoinKite and the Cold Card Hardware Wallet. You guys, withdraw, please, to Nodeless, the easiest way to plug in your digital and, you know, online services into Bitcoin, and Fold, the banking and debit card services that pay you in Bitcoin all the freaking time. You just get sats. I don't know how you could not want that one. I freaking love it. Links and goodies and free sats, all that stuff right there in the show notes. And again, one final thank you to Alex B for A Sound Bitcoin Financial System. Really good article, and I always love this discussion. So with that, thank you so much. Do not forget to subscribe. Check out AI Unchained as well. We have tons of exciting things coming, and I will catch you on the next episode. And until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. Man cannot discover new oceans unless he has the courage to lose sight of the shore. Andre Guide.